Chancellor and the Chancellor of the Exchequer never let a week pass now without protesting about the rising wages. Wages are going up too much, and they wish it would stop. So, the workers should always resist this sort of appeal to them, you know, not to, to press for higher wages. But it doesn't mean that workers should strike every occasion that offers and strike indiscriminately. There are times when it is absolutely useless for the workers to strike, or rather, I mean, they may strike just to show that the employers are there, you know, make a sort of protest, but they can't hope to get anything out of it. In the 1920 to 1925, when, for example, the wholesale price of coal dropped by 2/3, well, it was absurd for the miners in that situation to go along to the coal owners and say, look, your income's dropped by 2/3, we want the same wages we were getting before. I mean, they couldn't get it. I mean, the mines should be going out of existence in a situation like that. So what workers are always to do, of course, before they come out on strike, is sit down seriously and consider whether the market conditions and the state of the employer's trade are such that if they strike, they've got a reasonable chance of winning. But, I repeat, the only way the workers can influence their standard of living is through trade union organisation and trying to press for higher wages. Now, the Labour Party and the Tories both say that they are in favour of the workers' standard of living rising. And yet every government, Labour or Tory, from 1945 to date, has tried to prevent wages from rising. Take Attlee, the Labour Party Prime Minister in 1945. Before he became Prime Minister, he wrote a book. Very impressive book. I mean, it was telling you what would happen when you got a Labour government. He said he was going to abolish riches and poverty. He was going to abolish the rich and the poor. He was going to abolish the rich by punitive taxation and death duties, bring their income down. And he was going to raise the income of the workers by pushing wages up. Well, within 2 years of Mr. Attlee becoming Prime Minister of the 1945 Labour government, he and Stafford Cripps introduced the first, and I emphasise the first, of the wages and prices freezes to prevent wages from rising, which has been repeated in some form or other by every government since Tory and Labour. So the one thing the workers can do, and the Tories and the Labour Party, you know, both in abstract theory, they say we're in favour of wages going up. When it comes to it, they will always try to prevent wages going up and urge the workers to accept lower wages. And as I say, in a sense, you can't blame Attlee except for his ignorance. With all his good intentions, Attlee thought of a Labour government as the government that was going to abolish capitalism and establish socialism. But he hadn't got any mandate for it. And when he got into office, of course, he found that he was running capitalism, he was managing capitalism, he wasn't trying to abolish it. And there's only one way of running capitalism, of course, and that is the capitalist way. In conclusion, just to summarise it, I repeat again that at its formation and now, the Socialist Party of Great Britain has the unique position on rates and taxes of saying to the working class, it's none of your concern. Your standard of living does not depend on whether or not income tax is levied on your wages, and it doesn't depend on whether indirect taxes are high or low, it doesn't depend on whether prices generally are high or low, or rising or falling. It depends on the sort of resistance you can put up to the efforts of the employers to depress your standard of living. That's what it depends on. The capitalists have an enormous task to meet the expenditure of government. And what we say to the working class is, look, that cost of government falls on the only place where it can fall, that is on the property class. It doesn't fall on you, so don't let yourself be drawn into this struggle, which is not your affair, it's the affair of the capitalist class. You look after the one thing that you can do, which is organise and press for higher wages, whatever Labour and Tory governments may say to the contrary. And I repeat again that in the wage relationship, when the employing class have kept the workers wages, their standard would be down as far as trade union organisation and market conditions allow. It is not possible for the property cartel, the government, to come along then to the state, to the workers, and say, we're going to depress it still further by making you pay taxes. As Karl Marx pointed out, exploitation takes place at the point of production. That's where the battle lies, and that's where the workers can do something about it. But of course, finally, the working class ought to learn that no essential change in their conditions as an exploited class can take place within capitalism. I've mentioned a number of instances of them over quite long periods when the workers' standard of living has risen and some when it's fallen. But if I were going to make a guess, I would say the coming years are probably going to find that there will be some fall in the workers' standard of living again. I don't want to go into particular reasons, but I think it's likely to happen.
The working class cannot make capitalism work in their interest, and know that the government can do. The workers will raise their sights and aim to abolish the system itself and replace it with a socialist system of society.
Switzerland is one where they have always kept pretty tight control on things. Over the years, there's been very little inflation in Switzerland. The Swiss have a somewhat better understanding of monetary problems than some of the rest of the capitalist class. But if you want a general reason, you put a lot of it down to the poisonous influence of the theories of Mr. J.M. Keynes. Keynes came along in the 1930s and said to the British capitalist class and the American, he interviewed Roosevelt over the New Deal. And what he said to them was, look, capitalism is in a very dangerous state, you're in danger, you know, of revolution taking place, and I can stop it. I can abolish your unemployment for you. And incidentally, he chucked in, he said, I can abolish your wars due to economic causes. He said, if you carry out my policy, you'll have full employment here and countries won't be really interested in foreign markets, you'll get rewarded. Well, I mean, this caught on. The trade unions leapt it up. I mean, it was a matter of heaven for the trade unions, this belief that there was going to be no more unemployment and that they were going to have a steadily rising standard of living. But it caught on all over the world. Keynes' influence was enormous, and all sorts of other economists fell into the same sort of view. But it is not true that inflation has to be an international phenomenon. Each separate country can do what it likes. A very good example, 1920 to 1923, Germany went through hyperinflation, when prices were not just rising, 3 or 4% in a year, or even 3 or 4% in a day, they were rising 100% every day. And they got into the million levels. I mean, I've got some old German banknotes, million mark banknotes were quite worthless. But at the same time the German prices were going up like that, British prices were coming down like this because they were burning notes. While the Germans were getting the printing presses busy printing notes and putting them into circulation, the British government had ordered the Bank of England to reduce the note issue by burning millions of notes, and British prices came down. So you could have one country going up and another country coming down. And it's the same all of them. Keynes, you see, is not quite so, well, he's very much less popular than he was, and there are some countries who think that they also got to abandon Keynes and give up the idea that they can solve unemployment by spending money. It's up to the government to do what they like, subject, of course, to whether they understand what they're doing. See, the Tory and Labour governments, and there are hundreds of economist advisers who have been responsible for British prices going up so that they're 21 times what they were in 1938, didn't believe that their policy was sending up prices. When I said here, I wrote to the Treasury about it, and the Treasury said, money, the currency has no effect on prices, whatever. It doesn't matter how much money you spend, or you print or don't print, it doesn't affect prices. Well, if the Treasury could believe this, because Keynes told them so, and that, by the way, Keynes didn't. Keynes was not so silly as they think. What Keynes said, look, don't worry about controlling the amount of currency. But he said no government would be so irresponsible as to take advantage of it and print masses more currency. Because, as the man I quoted earlier, Professor Cannon, said to Keynes at the time, you don't understand governments. If there's an easy way of doing things, the governments would do it. And they have done. But to say that it's an international phenomenon is only true to this extent that they happen all to have gone in for inflation at the same time, but at very different rates. If you look at America, for example, American prices haven't risen since 1938 by half the amount that English prices have risen. And Swiss prices have risen less still. And if the Swiss want to, they can do what the British did in 1920, bring prices down, simply lower notes.
You mentioned earlier that rates rise at the expense of rates. Now, in South London, our area, Swindon area, in the last 15 years, rents have gone up by about a factor of 5 to 6, and the rates by a similar amount. And take a typical flat was let 15 years ago at £20 a week, it's now about 130. So the rates hasn't, the huge rise in rates hasn't happened in rent. It's far more than it, it's gone along with it.
Yeah, for two things. One, you see, you've got also to take into account first rent restriction and the what in fact is happening, the phasing out of rent restriction, which is all of it. I quoted you some figures more recently when the effect of rent restriction is now almost gone. So you're getting back to a normal sort of situation. See, when rent restriction was there, you would have rents rising, not for any economic reason, but simply because the government modified the Rent Acts to permit landlords to charge higher rents. So, as I say, it's insulated from the economic situation. For the period I quoted, rates rose enormously more, after the official index, rose enormously more than rents. But the two together moved hardly at all after you've discounted the general rise in price. I know that sounds complicated, but it is a statistical question. If you had a free market, you see, what the Socialist Party of Great Britain said in 1904, there was no rent restriction, there was, in effect, a free market both for building, for letting, and all the rest of it, and there the thing operates. But you mustn't take what happened in the period when there was rent restriction, when rents were frozen and then gradually released, because it's cut off from market forces. But come to later years, when market forces are beginning to operate again, you'll see happening in the same way.
Are you saying, in effect, that prior to 1914 there was a tenants market and a house purchases market rather than the opposite at the present time?
No, what I'm saying is in 1914 there was no rent restriction. And people could build houses, builders could come in and build any houses they wanted to. They could charge whatever rents the market would allow. And tenants, of course, could bargain with the employer and get any accommodation they rented, get that whatever the landlord, they could bargain with the landlord. But once you've got rent restriction, once the Tories introduce freezing rents and then gradual restriction, market forces don't show themselves in the figures for the rise of rents and rates. You've got to come along to a later period when the market is now becoming more free than it has been under rent restriction, as it was before 1914. 1914, of course, you built whatever houses you thought it worthwhile building. You let them if you could. The builder and the landlord suffered and he couldn't let them if the house was empty. But there are, I mean, that's the market condition, that's capitalism.
Yes, you mentioned that industrial profits have dropped from 60% to 30% from 1946 and 1977.
What it contributed to, it put a lot of manufacturing firms out of business. They were being undercut by competition from Germany and Japan and America. That's what happened to the manufacturing industries. In other words, the employers were in a weak position, both because of the strength of trade union organisation and because they couldn't produce manufactured goods able to compete with the goods pouring in from Japan and Germany and America. That's right, the manufacturing industry. So the employers' profits, the figure I quoted, by the way, was this. In order to discount the effect of rising prices anyway, if you take in 1948, the employers paid, I don't know what the figure was, say 10,000 million in wages and salaries, and their profits at that time would have been 6,000 million. In other words, 60%, the profits were equal to 60% of the wages bill. They fell year by year, so when you get to 1977, the employer's profits were actually only 29% of the wages bill. In other words, the workers all the time have been gaining at the expense of profits.
The point lack of demand anymore.
Well, yes, because prices have gone up, you see.
Oh, right, even real terms.
Well, actually, what you say is true, because productivity was increasing, so the employer's profits after you've discounted prices had risen a little over that period, but very, very little. The real rise was in wages in the manufacturer's profits. But unfortunately, there is another factor comes into this, I don't want to complicate it. The division of the national income isn't just between wages and salaries on the one hand and profits on the other. There's a third gang, the self-employed, we now number about 2 million. So at certain periods, you can appear to get wages and profits both rising because the share going to the self-employed, the one-man businesses and farmers, is falling. But I mean, that merely complicates it.
Is it strictly true that workers will no longer come in and do a man's job for a lower pay? And I'm thinking in terms of the electricians union, who even before their disgraceful conduct with the News International dispute, were doing deals with doing no strike deals and that type of thing with various, especially Japanese employers. And also, for example, the Breakaway Miners Union, who were basically an employers' union. And the idea of what's mooted is the new realism, which is, as far as I can see, essentially a capitalist realism, that they're going to do a deal with the bosses rather than stand with their workers.
Yeah, well, let's get this clear. What I said was that when trade unions, when the workers are effectively organised, unlike when Marx wrote in the 1860s, nowadays, if workers are out of work, they don't pour in to the employer saying, we'll do work for lower pay. Because trade union organisations are defensive. Well, the question raises two cases, the electricians and the Union of Democratic Miners. But it's overlooked the fact that the electricians are looking for a one union deal with the employer. I mean, this is the trade union attitude. Every trade union, if it can, wants to take over the members of all the other trade unions. It wants to have only one union. But they're doing it not for lower pay, but for higher pay. As far as the electricity and as far as the Union of Democratic Miners are concerned, they're getting higher pay than the members of the National Union of Mine Workers. It isn't a question of lower pay. It's a question, I mean, we'll go into this, of course. It arose for another reason. The Union of Democratic Miners was set up because the National Union of Mine Workers wouldn't take a ballot. So they came out on strike. And that's another question altogether. But it isn't a question of lower pay. What all the unions want. Back about 4 years ago, the former General Secretary of the Engineering Union got a lot of publicity. He made a speech saying that it's absolutely outrageous, the disorganisation of English workers. He said it takes 38 unions to build a motor car, which of course, from a workers' point of view, is absurd. And of course, it's also absurd from the employer's point of view. The employer would much rather deal with one union. But what that General Secretary of the AEU meant, he meant what the electrical trade union now means. He meant, I want all the workers to belong to my union. I don't want 38 unions. I want them to take in the lot. Only one union building my workers. But this is a bit of trade union politics. But it is not a question, it's not the situation that Marx envisaged, where the unemployed rush in and offer to do the work for lower pay. It just doesn't work. Now, it has worked in America, but then trade unions in America are very much weaker than they are here. I mean, the percentage of the American workers in trade unions is less than half what it is in this country.
Isn't it essentially the same thing, the same phenomenon of selling other sections of the working class or other members of the working class down the line?
Well, here you're going to trade in the politics. They're always willing to do it. There is no union in this country, out of the 300 odd unions, that exists for the benefit of the working class. They're organised to benefit their own members, and they act accordingly. I mean, when the National Union of Mine Workers are acting for their own minded members, they want more jobs for mine workers. So they said, let's put some oil workers and some gas workers and some nuclear power workers out of work. Let's put some foreign miners out of work. Let's go to the government and say, don't import coal. Close down the nuclear power stations. Put oil workers and gas workers out of work in order to create jobs for miners. Well, I mean, this is regrettable. And it's an attitude of all trade unions. They all do it. The railwaymen, you may have read in the papers today, the railwaymen has asked, and the Labour government has agreed, that when the next Labour government comes in, they'll re-employ 14,000 railway workers. Well, what do the road transport workers think about it? The road transport workers will say, we want road transport workers, we don't want railway workers. And they all do it. I mean, you can see it all through industry. But as I say, that is trade union politics, because there is no union that exists for the benefit of the working class. And they all try to look after their own members. That's all they do. I mean, there you are. It's regrettable. I mean, from the Socialist Party of Great Britain's point of view, the attitude was simple. Years ago, at its formation, the SPTV never gave blanket support to trade unions. What it said is, we will support actions of trade unions against their employers over wages and conditions, provided it's in the interest of the working class. Well, when you go into your trade union politics, because it isn't in the interest of the working class, but then they're not organised for this purpose.
Next question, please.
I'm still trying to understand what socialism is all about, but it seems to me that the working class have taken on this idea sort of imperceptibly about the one-class state, if not this one.
Sorry, just one more.
The one-class state, the working class, bring society closer to that sort of one-class state, the working class, which hasn't yet been achieved because of the owning class, related to the fact that under Thatcher, everyone has been encouraged to own shares and so on. It's now possible for person to be working for a company and yet helping the capitalist class to get richer, but also to own shares in that company and go on, in a way, distributing wealth far more. I'm wondering if whether the capitalist class are trying to offset the efforts of those who are working for the working class by making it possible for everyone to have a stake in everything.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I expect you've got the gist of this question. It's about the efforts of the Thatcher government in particular to encourage workers to be a share owner in democracy and buy shares in companies. Got to look behind, I mean, first, I'll deal with the motive later, but look behind it at the facts. The accumulated wealth of this country is concentrated in the hands of the rich. And the amount owned by the working class is very, very small. And the national income, the average income, so to speak, of the capital class is much higher than the average income of the working class. The average pay, by the way, of the 21 million workers who were in work last year was £155 a week. That's the average for the whole 21 million of them. The Thatcher government comes along and says, look, buy shares. But, you see, if the workers haven't got the money, they can only buy shares within the limits of their money. I mentioned here in an earlier lecture the firm of Pearson's, where there are a couple of shareholders in Pearson's, who are also directors, who own more than 2 million shares each. At the other end, there are about 15,000 small shareholders who own an average of about 200. You can, the 15,000 small shareholders can do what they like. They're never going to control the company. The company is going to be controlled by the people at the top who own millions of shares each. And the same is true of capitalism in general. The workers can only spend what they've got. And if she persuades, Thatcher government persuades them to buy shares of British Telecom or something like this, they only do this by giving up spending the money on something else. But don't forget, it isn't only the Tory party that has done this. the Liberal Party were engaged in it, in setting up Post Office Savings Bank, the trustee savings bank back in the 19th century, saying to the world, look, save your money, don't spend it on beer and oil and cigarettes and things like this. Put it in the Post Office Savings Bank and you'll get a regular, your money's safe, you'll get a regular interest, what is it, 2.5%, something like this. But later on, the Labour Party itself and the Trade Union Congress officially supported the National Savings Movement. Now, it's true they weren't saying to the workers buy shares, but they were saying to the workers the same thing. They were saying buy savings bonds and things like this. Officially, the Labour Party was a TUC, so it's not a Tory thing. But the important thing to remember is it's not going to make any difference to the distribution of wealth. The distribution of wealth takes place in industry itself. In other words, the workers get as much as they can and the employers pay them as little as they can. And it's no use saying to the workers, come on, buy out Pearson's, buy out Barclays, buy out ICI and all the rest of it. The workers haven't got the money to do it. But of course, about the motive, it's simple. The motive is simply this, that if you can persuade the workers to save some money and buy British Telecom shares and buy shares and the other things that are available, it'll give the workers an interest in the company and they'll work harder and they won't come out on strike. Well, profit sharing schemes have been going for a century now and they haven't had that. I mean, they have a certain effect like this, but not much. It's rather interesting. When the Labour Party re-nationalised the steel industry, the man who was in charge of personnel for the British Steel Corporation persuaded them, at the request of the steel workers' trade unions, to put workers' representatives on the provincial boards of the British Steel Corporation as the directors on the provincial boards. And when the steel workers came out on strike, the directors came out on strike too. And so it didn't make a lot of difference.
Any more questions?
What is the relationship between the homeowner and rates? Is he classed as a landlord?
Well, that's certainly not classed. Well, yes, he is for some purpose. See, the homeowner gets the, maybe you've got a mortgage, he gets the advantage of the law which makes interest untaxed. But incidentally, I noticed that there's quite a growing demand in financial circles to get rid of them over there as well. But I mean, see, what is the point of it? If the worker, instead of being in a rented house, becomes a homeowner by buying a flat or a house on a mortgage, they do so because they're persuaded that they will be owners and that they'll be better off than the rest of it. Because as their experience shows, most of them are not better off, they're worse off. In blocks of flats, I know, people were persuaded to buy or get long leases on the flats. But when they get a long lease on the flats, they've still got to rely on the landlord to do the outside repairs and things like this and charges. And what they found is, of course, after they bought the flat, they had no control over the amount that was going to be charged. And I'm not sure, and some of the guys will probably know, whether an act has yet been passed to try to control this, but they have been better off. I mean, my own guess would be that workers are better off to be in rented property than in property that they own. I mean, they only land themselves with a lot of additional problems.
Yes? Is there anyone else? Any other questions?
Well,
someone who has an answer?
Really, I wanted to comment on the proposition, Thatcher's proposition to get rid of rates. It is produced what she calls a poll tax. It's a very good one, but that's interesting.
This is only a Tory Party proposal. It has been all the other, the Liberals and the SDP and the Labour Party sometime have at least looked into this sort of thing. And it seems to me that it isn't, I mean, it won't make it into the working class. At present, they collect a certain amount as rates. Now, suppose they get rid of rates and make it a kind of income tax. In other words, people, instead of paying rates according to the size of the house they live in, pay a tax which is related to their income. They'll collect the same amount of money as before, but it will be differently distributed. And incidentally, of course, one of the rating reforms they propose is to put rates on farmers. Farmers are exempt from rates for various purposes, and of course the farmers strongly object to they being brought in. But again, of course, governments have to raise money where they can, and that may be the lot of it. But I know what happens whenever somebody comes along and says, let's reform the rating system, or let's reform the taxation system, or whatever else they do, if they persuade everybody to think, look, if we do this, you'll be better off. Well, of course, they don't emphasize to them that if you change it from a rating system to something related to income tax, some will be better off and some will be worse off. Inevitably, it's the same amount of money that's going to be raised. I would say that, you know, in the long run, they make no difference. The day after a rating reform is introduced, there'll be new people lobbying to get it changed again into something else. But I would like, if anybody can think of it, I raise this question as why the capitalist class or the government don't go back to the 19th century and cut out all the tax on wages and rely on indirect taxation or corporation tax. Can anybody think of any other reason why they don't do it? I mean, I've given two. One, they just don't understand it. And secondly, that at the back of their minds, they think it's a good thing that everybody should pay taxes.
It's a cheap way of collecting money for the government.
Well, it isn't cheap.
Well, why do you? From my mind, there is a Parkinson catch. You see, you've got these people in civil servants and bureaucracy and self-perpetuating good people who want this kind of thing to happen. They want to have jobs, they want to, you know, we can maintain offices and empires and so on. I mean, this is part of capitalism. I mean, for example, you hear these different people, for example, you listen to the, as this is a bit of a debate, the chief constable's meeting a year or so ago. And every one of those exceptions said, look, we need more policemen. Well, you, last week the customs excise people were saying, look, we need 200 more customs people, we need 12,000 more teachers. Well, this is a self-perpetuating thing. The workers have got this idea that, you know, that here's capitalism, we ought to build up these institutions. I mean, as I say, this Parkinson's business, there's work there, you bring the bots in, and this is it. This is what the Labour Party is trying to look at.
Half of our comrade answer said it can also be construed, PAYE, that is, as a means testing, how the means test. For instance, a single man pays a lot more than a married man, or the question of tax allowances. Might suit the capitalist class, and it has suited the capitalist class probably, as a means of allowing those worse disabled children or other responsibilities higher income than those who haven't. Which wasn't the case before it was a blanket wage for all and sundry.
Well, of course, about this, I mean, this does raise in mind me of the question of family allowances, children's allowances. The woman, what was her name, who led the campaign for this?
Rathbone.
Rathbone spoke at what she thought was a private meeting in which she laid down what she was after. She said, look, the trade unions want higher wages. It's impossible for capitalism to give them higher wages. But what we could do, we could make the unmarried man and the unmarried woman give up their cigarettes and tobacco so that we can pay children's allowances to the married men. I don't remember this because somebody was there, gave me a copy of the thing, and I handed it over to some of the publishers. She's curious at the idea that what she said at the private meeting should be disputed.
You had a question?
Yes. Father-in-law of mine is a solicitor. It's on the question of buying capital or mortgage. He said, can you tell me the trend that's happening now? People in their 50s and over who bought their house on mortgage are coming into a situation where by their parents on both sides are dying and they're inheriting, say, a couple hundred thousand pounds in the value of two houses. How would it affect the general working class position? How much better off working class in the future?
Well, the fact that the selling price of houses has gone up enormously. Well, I'll tell you one thing. If you're moving from London, say, to Newcastle, fine, you sell a house for $100,000, and you get a price in a house in Newcastle half the price. What happens if you're moving from Newcastle to London? Which of course happens. And what's going to happen when, if and when, inflation does stop and the price of houses starts coming down? I mean, the building society have already complained that they're having to take over an increasing number of properties because the people can't pay the mortgage. What happens if the price of houses come down? And they're all in this position. suddenly all of them find that this imagined bonanza that they had in the rising price of houses stopped. As if, yeah, I wanted to say some more about taxing the rich in order to have a redistribution of wealth, to have more hospitals and social services and so on. Could you give me an example, or refer me to a book, just grab an example, of how far can you tax somebody before it starts affecting jobs and investment and so on?
Well,
this raises a lot of questions. The people who, the Labour Party didn't start with it. Back in the 19th century, they had inheritance taxes simply to raise revenue. They weren't trying to destroy the rich, but as I said, if you want to raise money, you've got to raise the money where the money is. So they had inheritance duties in the 19th century. Along in the 1920s, the Labour Party came out with a brand new program, capital levy. They said, we're going to take a lot of wealth away from the rich and give it to the poor. And I quoted earlier what Attlee said before he became Labour Prime Minister. He said they were going to tax the rich and reduce the wealth of the rich and bring it to the poor by pushing up wages. Well, you see, if you're running capital, you can't push up wages beyond a certain point. Capitalist concerns are only in business because they can make a profit. If the workers decide that they will not work for a wage which allows the employer to make a profit, the employer goes bust and they're out of work. I mean, this is the Achilles heel of all the people who think they can reform capitalism. But the capital levy was particularly interesting. A member of the Socialist Party of Great Britain had correspondence with the man, Patrick Lawrence, who ran the campaign for the Labour Party. And their argument was this, that they said, look, Britain is being prevented from expanding because of the weight of the national debt. We've got to pay all that interest on the national debt. If we were to raise a capital levy, take a lot of wealth away from rich people and use it to pay off the national debt, then the national debt would be smaller and the industry would start rising again. I mean, the argument is nonsense. In order to, in the main, the people who own the national debt are the people who are paying taxes for the interest on the national debt. So you just take a lot of their wealth away, take their wealth away from them, and they now no longer have to pay interest on the national debt, so you're where you are. He put it to Patrick Lawrence, he said, all it is a transfer of wealth between wealthy persons, and Patrick Lawrence agreed. He said so, he said, yes, I mean, I know, that's what it is. But all the inheritance duties and all the taxation on the rich is far higher than it was in the 19th century. Even in the 19th century, when the rich paid income tax, it was only about 2 or 3 pence in the pound. Well, you've now, the basic rate is now 29, and at a higher level, it goes much higher. But the rich, it hasn't ended the rich, because the rich make their wealth not because they do or do not pay taxes, because they exploit the workers at the point of production. Every week that the worker, the capitalist employs a worker, he's making a profit out. If he doesn't make a profit out, he scraps him and he goes under the unemployment level. So when you ask what would be its effect on unemployment, as Marx pointed out, a simple thing. That if he said wages can rise unto the point where there's no more profit. They can't rise above the point where there's no profit, or at least not for long, because the employer goes out of business. So every government, whether it's Labour or Tory, has to consider this question. And every government since 1945 has imposed a wage freeze and price policy. But I mean, it's quite useless. Capitalism doesn't go into a decline because of taxation. I mentioned earlier, taxation in the 19th century was only a fraction of what it is now, and you had the Great Depression. Taxation is now very high, and we had the 1979 depression. Depressions happen for a quite different reason. Depressions happen because of the way capitalism produces wealth. Imagine at the end of a depression when things are expanding again, every industry and every company moves in and says, look, we've got to produce as fast as we can, as much as we can, because the market's expanding. And they don't sit back and say, oh, look, we mustn't produce too much because we don't know how much of the market we're going to get. Each rival company in each country says, look, the faster we get in, the more we get out of the market. Well, inevitably, after a few years, particular industries have produced too much. Shipbuilding produced too much. Steel produced too much. Coal produced too much. When the mining strike began, coal board said they got 50 million tons of coal scattered around the country that in ordinary circumstances would take them 10 years to get rid of. This happens. When an industry or a few big industries overproduce, they cut back production and they stop investment. And then they stand off workers. When they do that, the workers stop buying and the other people, the textile people and the food people are affected. And so you spiral downward. And it will go on until there comes a time when a various combination of reasons, either development of new industries or the exploitation of old ones, enough capitalists feel that they can move in, invest again and make a profit. And that's how capitalism goes. It doesn't matter how you tax people or what intentions you may have. I mean, all right, assume that the Labour Party had all the good intentions in the world at me. It was going to make the rich poor and the poor rich so that they're all on the level income. You can't run capitalism like that. And of course the Russians found the same in Russia. They found they couldn't. Remember, Lenin, shortly after they got power in Russia, said they were going to run Russia, they didn't call it capitalism, whatever it was, going to run Russia so that everybody's income was the same, right across the board. After a year, he said it won't work, we've got to scrap it, and he scrapped it. But he said it was a regrettable necessity, implying that when it ceased to be a regrettable necessity, they'd come back to it. And that's how many, 70 years ago. Of course they're not going to come back to it. The people who've got political power in Russia do what every people do who've got political power. They fill their pockets at the same time. They'd be astonished if they didn't.
Any more questions?
I was very interested when you mentioned the entertainment tax. I remember the big campaign against the entertainment tax in the cinemas, but when the government took away the entertainment tax, it didn't alter the price of the seat cinema at all. You were paying the money to the film industry rather than to the government. And I was going to say, once the price has been set and the taxes are, there's no reason why they can't, if the government take it away, why they can't keep on charging it.
Well, I mean, because the cinema industry shrunk, that's all. Mm. I mean, it was a booming industry. But I remember at the time, when there were campaigns to get rid of the entertainment tax, they would say to everybody, look, our charges are so high because we're going to pay tax. Implying that when the tax was gone, they reduced the charges. Within months of the abolition of the entertainment tax, the official price index for the entertainment group of services was up, but down.
Anyone else?
Yes, sorry, I'm going to get back to this PYE business again. I understand that at the beginning of the war, the government of the day approached, this is before PYE was introduced, approached the big boys like ICI and people back, probably about a dozen big companies, with their plans for introducing PYE. And of course he examined it and were very reluctant about taking it on. I suppose there were industry-wide basis of fact and business and we had amazing money to fight the war and all this business. Well, they got lumbered with this and subsequently all of our firms, once the big men out of them, everyone else had a policy. So what I meant was to keep them away, I was thinking in terms of the governmental method of having to raise that tax, however much money they want. At the time it was the best way of doing it, but of course it's carried on and on and on, and it looks as though the capitalist class will have to keep on paying to the UAE as long as capitalism exists.
Well, see, it can't be as simple as that. Apart from they did manage in the 19th century with no tax on wages. They raise their money otherwise. About the PAYE, I don't know if it's great, I was told at the time that the scheme for PAYE came from some trade union people in the Inland Revenue Staff Federation. One of the things they wanted to get over, before the last war, income tax, including income tax on workers' wages, was levied every year and worked out and so on, and they came up against the problem of the moonlight fit. the workers who were disappearing from their addresses of being the apostle. But of course, if it's deducted by the employer out of wages, this can't happen. But I would have thought myself that if you know they could see this problem as it actually is, that it would be cheaper for the government, and certainly for the employers, to get rid of PAYE and rely on, say, corporation tax. Now, 35% tax on company profits, they've got to do it anyway, put it up to 40 or 50, 45%, and cut out the tax on wages. Incidentally, of course, I mentioned earlier the enormous growth in the civil service, but of course you've had an enormous growth of bureaucracy in industrial companies. I mentioned the manufacturing industry, 1948 to 1977. The Department of Statistics published each year the number of what they call wage earners and the number of salary earners. Over a period of 19 years, the wage earners dropped by about a million, and the salary earners went up by 800,000. And I guess most of those were doing PAYE work. And I mean, the employers could save it. I'm sure the employers would rather have wage earners producing wealth than PAYE people just shoving around bits of paper for the revenue department. Oh, I mean, I would hope one would suppose they know their own business.
If I could just make a point regarding this. I don't know if Conroy Hardy can tell us a bit more about bankruptcies. I noticed he's got it at the top here. Because I read a case the other day where workers had gone to the unemployment office to get their money and they couldn't get it because the employers had not paid it. And surely this must occur in lots of cases where there are bankruptcies.
Well, I mean, you've got this question. When a firm goes bankrupt, what happens about the PAYE? No, this I've recently taken in a book on income tax, and they say legally the obligation is ultimately on the worker. And if the firm goes bankrupt, even if you can still go to the worker and say, where's your PAYE? But my chairman refers to my having no idea about bankruptcy. It's just an illustration of the point I've made. If the workers wage and the costs, all the costs are such that companies can't make a profit, they go out of existence. In the 5 years since 1981, there have been something like 100,000 bankruptcies and company liquidations. Now, it's the last thing that Mrs. Thatcher's government wanted to do. They don't want firms to go bankrupt. But it only emphasises the point that there's very little governments can do about the running of capitalism. Capitalism runs its own way once you've got it established. It's based on profit. It creates unemployment. Governments do nothing about it. They can't prevent unemployment. And the Thatcher government, much as she would have liked to see firms making profits, she couldn't prevent companies going bankrupt and profits falling. This is what happens. And there's only one thing, or one of the few things that governments can do. They can control the general price level, but they don't know how to. So for 50 years, they've been hoping to prevent prices rising, and then have been setting prices up. How pure it goes.
Yes, Comrade Easton.
The point you made about printing money, you mentioned that fallacy of past government years that the government has printed money and that has caused inflation. What is the difference between printed money and what is actually done? What was it actually done precisely?
Well, printing excess currency does cause inflation, but the amounts are so tiny that they don't. No government ever went in for inflation in order to raise revenue. The amount of currency that's notes and coin in circulation in 1938 is under 500 million. On the latest figure, it's 12,800 million. In other words, it's multiplied by about 20, 25, or 30, something like this. This has been the major cause, not the only one. By the way, Karl Marx showed quite clearly that the monetarists were quite wrong. There are other factors. Boom and depression come into prices. Value comes into prices. In every boom, in the 19th century, they had a gold standard. And prices were therefore stabilised as far as capitalism can stabilise it. In every boom, prices go up a bit. Every depression, they come down a bit, quite independent of the currency. But the printing the additional, putting additional currency into circulation, that's notes and coin, raising it from 500 million to 12,800 million, has been a major cause of putting up prices. But you see the amounts of trifling. I mean, in how many years? 50 years, they've increased the amount of currency by something like 12,000 million. What is this in relation to expenditure this year of 128,000 million? Just doesn't count. But governments could do this, but no British government has done it. They've done it for other reasons. They do it in wartime. I mean, there's a very good reason in 1914 and 1939 for abandoning control of the currency. And that is this. In 1914, there was a lot of gold circulating around the country in the form of gold coins, gold in bank vaults. Well, the government had to call it all in, because if they wanted to buy raw materials or armaments from America, the Americans said, gold, we want gold. We're not going to take Bank of England notes any longer. So they had to get the gold, the same in 1939. In a wartime, people buy the sellers want gold, and so they called in the gold, and therefore they abandoned the control of the currency. If they wanted to reduce the price of the game, they have to do it what they did in 1920. That's burn a lot of millions of notes down the pump. But as I say, you're up against the fact that their own economic advisors, the hundreds of these people churned out of the universities, so-called economists, these are the people who have been advising the government. They're the people who have been saying to the government, look, you don't have to worry about the currency, as the Treasury said to me, it has no effect on prices. Pure bloody ignorance.
What is it?
It comes back to the Keynes again. In the 19th century, Adam Smith, rather vaguely, Ricardo, better, Karl Marx, Jevons, and Professor Cannon in the 1920s all understood currency quite well. They knew that if you put an excess amount of currency into circulation, it puts up prices, in addition to all the other factors. Alternatively, if you burn notes and withdraw currency in circulation, it'll put prices down. This they knew, and it was known to the government's advisers. The Lloyd George government in 1919 set up a cumulative committee of a number of bankers to look into the subject, and they understood it perfectly well. They said, you want to stop inflation, prices have been shooting out from 1914 to 1920. They said to the government, you want to stop it, just burn some notes. So the Treasury issued an instruction to the Bank of England, which rather complicated thing, but it told them in effect, you've got to reduce the note issue. And they did, and the prices came down. He said, no, they haven't got any people who understand currency now. They've got all these people, these half-baked people churned out of universities. I know one of them, an economist, city editor on a newspaper, I've told it here before. 3 or 4 years ago, he went to an international conference on currency. And he came back, wrote an article, and said, Keynes is dead. So I wrote to him and said, look, you've been right, putting your stuff over the years and years. Why didn't you know that Keynes was rubbish when you began? You see, what did you learn in university? He was very candid. He wrote and said, I didn't study economics at university, I only read Keynes. I mean, this is the position of the world. So now, they do not know what they are doing. So when the Treasury says, prices go up, but the currency has nothing to do with it, what they've been taught, and this is what they believe. Now, why Keynes was responsible was this. I said Keynes was not in favour of inflation, he wasn't. He said it out perfectly plainly. He said the choice would be between having a slightly falling price level and stable wages, or having a stable price level and gradually rising wages, and he favoured stable price level and gradually rising wages. But he also said, look, in order to stabilise prices, you don't need to have any formal control of the note issue. Because, as I said before, he said no government would be so irresponsible as to behave irresponsibly and print a lot of notes. But of course, this is what they've been doing. But they can blame Keynes for having given them the wrong advice. And at the time, Professor Cannon said to him, you don't understand government, you say they won't be irresponsible. Of course they will be. But it wasn't his intention. Now, these people have been brought up, and what Keynes said to them, he went on to say, look, you don't want to worry about the currency, the note issue. What you want to worry about is bank lending. That if banks lend them a lot of money, that will put up prices. If they don't lend them a lot of money, that won't put up prices, they even hold them down. Which is, of course, a piece of utter nonsense. This is what Keynes believed. But he didn't think that it was going to lead to inflation, which of course it has. I mean, if you, I know it sounds incredible, but what these people believe, and it isn't only Keynes, it's Professor Milton Friedman, the monetarist, spells it out. If I may give an example, they believe this. They say that banks create money. So that, if I may give an example, if you have £1,000 and you lent it to ICI or bought some shares in ICI, that would be £1,000. And the effect, any effect it had on prices would be £1,000. They believe, and they spelled it out in the Macmillan Committee report 1931, they say, but it's different. If you give it to a bank, if you deposit it in a bank, then you deposit £1,000 in the bank isn't restricted to lending £1,000, they can lend £9,000. They actually, on current figures, it would be about £90,000. In other words, they say the bank creates this deposit. So what they're saying is, if you lend the money directly to ICI, it only has the effect of £1,000 on prices. If you put it to a bank and they lend it to ICI, it will have nine times the effect, or now it will be as worth more. Of course, it's a load of rubbish. Banks don't create anything, and they can't create anything. Banks can only lend what depositors choose to deposit with them to lend to. But all these people believe differently. And you look up the textbooks, they'll tell you so. They'll tell you banks, they say, banks create credit. And they don't. And as of course Marx showed, banks don't create anything. They merely borrow money from one old people and lend it to another, or rather lend much less. They can't lend the whole lot, they lend less to somebody else. There are. This is what these people believe. I can only suppose that sometime or other, somebody will come, economists will come forward and say, let's look at all this again. Let's go back to Ricardo or Gerard Day. I didn't even say go back to Karl Marx. though, of course, that's it, that the universities are told not to waste their time on Karl Marx. And, of course, a lot of the alleged Marxists say, don't waste your time on Marx's economics, it was all wrong.
They say it's all out of
date. It's all out of date. But I would repeat here what I've already said. The former editor of the Times, what was his name again? Rees-Mogg went over the Arts Council. He became dissatisfied with all the stuff the Treasury and these others were came to be putting out. And he undertook a re-study. He went back and did his homework. And he'd be with Adam Smith and Ricardo and Jevons and a lot of others. And the last article he wrote before he left the Times was, he said he'd come to the conclusion you couldn't go without the labour theory of value. And it was given another year or two to be back to Marx.
A quick question. Can you help me to explain the motivation behind this, the government's which makes funds available to ailing and failing companies and so on? Everyone's heard of the rescue of Rolls Royce and so on. That was related to national pride, but recently the government put a lot of money into the tin mines in Cornwall, and the money there promised to keep being produced in a way beyond the world price of it. I couldn't understand why the government put money on sale.
Well, let's come back to capitalism. This is the matter I've referred to before. Professor Cannon gave evidence that the coal commission back in the 1990s. And they said to him, what would you do about all these coal mines, hundreds of mines, in their contributors over the falling price of coal? And Cannon said, you ought to want to somehow be bankrupted, let them go. In other words, Cannon said, no, this is capitalism, this is the way to run capitalism, if they can't find their way, let them go. But then something else steps in. Politics and war step in. There are some industries which the government won't let go because they need them in time of war. If they let railways to face road competition, the railways would have disappeared. But they still want the railways in wartime. Same as over the Inland Telegraph Service. The Inland Revenue Service never paid its way. It always runs a dead loss. But the government kept it going because they said, look, we'll need this network in wartime. And this is the fact. But there is a political reason. See, mention has been made of the government having coughed up some money for tin mines in Wales. But incidentally, they're another tin mine they won't save. But there are voters in Wales, and they're afraid of the appearance of it. My own view is that Mrs. Thatcher, who is not a Tory at all, but an old Adam Smith 19th century liberal, would have wanted to let all these things go. I mean, from an economic point of view, she would have taken Cannon's advice. Bankruptcy, then you go bankrupt. Then Rolls Royce go bankrupt, which is the, then politics and prestige come into it. And all her associates, or most of them, will say, well, look, you can't let this go, cough up some money, keep their head above water. So they'll put forward the excuse that if they put enough money into Cornish tin, the time may come when the price of tin will go up again and they'll be able to pay their way. But I mean, this is politics. The same applies to the whole farming industry. In the 1950 when the war broke out, this country was being blockaded by German submarines and a great shortage of food. The government wanted more food. They came forward with the Coal Production Act. They poured enormous amounts of money into the farming industry and attached to it a minimum wage for agricultural workers, because they also wanted workers to move into agriculture. So they enormously increased the output of food during wartime. 1921, war was over, no war like that, they scrapped it. And they've been doing the same, of course, in the Second World War. And they did the same for the mines, by the way. Well, then time came when oil was cheaper than coal, and nuclear power was going to be cheaper still. So the Thatcher government wanted to get out of subsidies for the mines. And they wanted to get out of subsidies for agriculture. But as some commentator pointed out, in Mrs. Thatcher's government, there were quite a number of farmer landlords who would take a very dim view of letting agriculture go to the war. In the early days of capitalism, the first half of the 19th century, when the factory owners wanted cheap food, and at that time agriculture was protected by the corn laws, the factory owners came along and said, bust it, let's abolish the corn laws. If it ruins agriculture, so what? As long as we get cheap food, of course that cheap food means cheap wages. And the same will be there to do now. But all the time, on the one side they've got the economic factor of running capitalism, and the other side they've got politics and also possible war needs. And they have to weigh up the two together.
Question?
Surely it's not good enough, you know, a common target that in case you go to the workers, you know, you go and stay, put the real life, you know, and bring the pros and cons. Well, it's better, you know, to work and stay, or it is better to hold on to the jobs. What are particularly what you need of the social advantage to commit themselves to do with this, you see? In the defecation line, you know, regarding black legs and scabs, surely, this and the conformity, subjectation, you know, of what happens, you know, conformity to the system, they eventually, you can actually point your finger and turn around and say, there isn't a scab, there isn't a black leg in these days, I mean, take for instance, you know, the well-known CP. They've actually got people, you know, in this so-called state, getting to the dark side now. You've got the electricity couple there. And it's bound to be, you know, that the union there are going to condone what happens. So I would say, you know, that it's inadvisable. In fact, it's none of their business that workers go out and strike. If they want to grow up with capitalism, well, that is their business. And that is trade union business. If they want to go out and strike, that's fair enough. But we can understand why they go out and strike. We could never, give any advice on one way or the other.
Well, I mean, it's a point of view. But in the early days of the Social Enterprise Great Group, a number of who members had a lot of experience in trade union did get some very useful advice to the trade union movement. They said, look, you can't starve the capitalist class out, or employers, or the government. If you find the strike doesn't work quickly, pack it up and wait for a better opportunity.